Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Pamela Brewer welcoming you to this edition of Friday on the Other Side here at Mind Talk. Every Friday, you and I have the opportunity to explore a broad range of experiences that folks have and experience both the psychological impact and any other impact that they may have. Today's guest, I am very pleased to introduce to you, is Dr. Johnny Bowden, who is also known as the Nutrition Mythbuster. He is a nationally known expert on weight loss and health. He's been seen on Dr. Oz. Everybody's heard of Dr. Oz. He's been on major television networks. If it has to do with nutrition and health, it seems like Dr. Johnny Bowden has been there and done that. Hello, Dr. Bowden. Welcome to
Hi,
my
Hi, how are you, Dr. Brewer? Nice to talk to you.
Same here. Now,
and please call me Johnny.
I will call you Johnny.
Good.
And your job is to call me Pamela.
Good.
Okay.
We're done.
Okay.
Done and done.
All right.
Good.
That was simple. I'd yeah. like to talk about your personal story before you became so engaged in the world of nutrition and healthy living. Tell us a little bit about Johnny as a little one and an adolescent. What was going on in your life?
Well, interesting that you asked. So I was, when I got interested in health and fitness and all of that stuff, I was working as a professional musician. I grew up in the era of sex, drugs, and rock and roll and Woodstock, and I looked and my health was approximately what you would expect it to be if someone grew up in that era. I mean, my idea of a healthy breakfast as a musician was like a cigarette, aspirin, and coffee sometime around 11 a.m. While trying to wake up the cobwebs from my brain. So I was very, very far from a healthy, vital, optimistic, engaged, and you know, vibrant person. I was kind of, you know, making a living, doing well. I was a fairly happy person, but I definitely was kind of physically a mess. Now, I had had my own personal battles with drug addiction and alcoholism all through my musician career. It went on into the, you know, 70s and early 80s. And I guess around, I suppose it was around the mid 80s, I was doing a show. I did a lot of musical theater, kind of the R&B and rock and pop kind of musicals, like Little Shop of Horrors and Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat and Chess and things like that. That was kind of my niche. And we were touring with a company, and I just was bored out of my mind during the day, and there were all these actors, and it was kind of their job to stay in shape. So they'd all go to the gym where they'd lift weights, and one day, just out of boredom, I said, all right, show me, you know, what is this? How do you lift weights? What do you do? And I remember one of the actors there was kind of a bodybuilder type guy, Mike, and he started to show me how to do a bicep curl. Well, it started really slowly, Pamela. I mean, I was not one of these people who had a revelation and changed their life and saw the light. And the next day, you know, I was one of those guys who I got to the gym, I'd do a set of bench presses, and I'd go out and smoke a cigarette on the break. So it was a long transition for me. But once I got bitten by this fitness bug, I literally saw my body, my energy, my outlook begin to transform. And it's a very powerful experience. It's one thing to know about something technically. It's one thing to read about it. It's one thing to understand it intellectually. It's another thing to physically experience it. And I started to see pounds coming off. I started to make slight changes to my diet. I started to get a little bit more interested in physical fitness and what I was eating and what I was doing. And gradually, I just changed my lifestyle. Before long, I knew where, you know, we toured a lot. I knew where the gym in every city was. I knew where we didn't have Whole Foods and stuff like that. We're going back to the early 80s. We had health food stores, which were kind of they used to call them back in the, I'm really dating myself, but they used to call us health nuts. People who would actually go into these weird little health food stores and eat all these kind of things like Tiger's milk bars and Brewer's yeast and all of the stuff. And nobody really knew what any of that was. There wasn't a big consciousness about this kind of thing. People who took vitamins were considered kind of weird. And I gradually kind of began to understand this world. I knew where the health food stores were. I knew where the organic food stores were in every city. And I knew where the gym was in every city. And I started spending a lot of time doing that. And I just became bitten by the bug. I loved this new way of life. And being a kind of academically oriented, upper middle class Jewish, overachieving kid, the first thing that I thought of was, I wonder if I can get a degree in this. I wonder, there must be, I mean, how do we get a degree in this? And I, to be very, very brutally honest, what I was thinking in the back of my mind was, boy, will that look sexy on a playbill. A playbill is the thing that they give out in the theaters that tells you, you know, who the actors are and who the playwright is and you know, what the musical is about and who the conductor is. And so I'd always have a bio as the conductor or the musical director. I'd always have a bio in the playbill. And I thought to myself, how sexy. Boy, to say, you know, he's done these number of shows and he went to Juilliard and he did this and he studied with Herbie Hancock and he's also a certified personal trainer. And I thought, boy, that wouldn't I get girls with that one? and that was kind of part of the motivation, but part of it was also I loved this stuff and there was no real way to learn about it. I mean, all we had at the time were idiot magazines like Muscle and Fitness, you know, which were just filled with people who took steroids and you know, a lot of bad advice and always, you know, really commercially oriented towards taking this protein supplement or that protein supplement. That was no way to learn about this stuff. So I kept thinking there must be some organization, some school, some place where you could actually, you know, really learn exercise physiology, kinesiology, anatomy, and all of the stuff. And sure enough, it turns out there were a lot of places to get certified as a personal trainer. So I signed up for one of those places, and I took the course, and I got certified. And it only made me want more. I thought, this is unbelievable. I want to take some. I want to learn more. So I started collecting certifications, and I ultimately, over the course of a couple of years, wound up with six of them. I got the Aerobics and Fitness Association of America, the American Council on Exercise, the American College of Sports Nutrition, the National Academy of Sports Nutrition. I got them all. And, of course, I never used any of them. I never trained anybody, but I knew about them. And then one day I was actually doing a show in my hometown of New York City, and which meant that I just worked at night and basically had my days free. And I was walking up Amsterdam Avenue, and I see that this new gym is opening. And it's got a lot of bells and whistles, and it looks really classy, and it looks really sexy, and it's black and gray, and it's got this weird name called Equinox. And I think to myself, and they're hiring because they're about to open. So I walk in to the little tiny office above this area where they're constructing it. And there's a small office. It was run. I don't know if anybody knows this, but the Equinox was started by a family, an Italian family in New Jersey, and the brothers and sisters ran it. And I walked in, and there they were. And I said, I hear you're hiring. And they said, we are. And what do you do? And I said, well, I'm a personal trainer. Now, remember, I'd never had my hands on a client. But I sure did know those exercise machines, and I sure was passionate about it. And I had my certification in hand. And for reasons unbeknown to me, they hired me. So I started as a personal trainer on the floor of the very first Equinox that ever opened in the United States in 1990, 91, something like that, on Amsterdam Avenue in Manhattan.
How'd you do with your first client? Do you remember your first client?
I did well. I'll tell you why. And this kind of dovetails a little bit into the rest of the story. So this was a second career for me. I was not, when I started this in 1990, a 22-year-old surfer boy, you know, who was the way the trainers basically looked. So I was already in my 40s, and people tended to talk to me a lot. I didn't mention this part of my story, but along the way, I picked up a master's in psychology while I was doing my music career. And I had at one point really hoped and dreamed of being a clinical psychologist. So I was in a PhD program. I got my master's. And as a result, I think it made me, that and my age, and made me a pretty good listener. And I don't know if you've ever worked with personal trainers, but there tends, with all coaches or instructors, there tends to be a lot of flow of information back and forth and a lot of sharing. And, you know, people would talk to me about their problems and about their problems with their body and about their feelings about their body and about their challenges in breaking through and sticking to a diet and sticking to an exercise program, all the things that everybody struggles with this stuff. And over the course, I stayed at Equinox as a trainer on the floor, and eventually became the dean of the Equinox Fitness Training Program, which I'm proud to say, when we developed that program at Equinox back in the 90s, it is now really the model for how personal trainers are trained at every gym in America.
Exciting.
And we developed a great program. I was the dean. And during that time, those years that I was there, I learned a lot of things that contradicted what we had been taught in personal training school. And this is really what started my journey towards where I am now. When I began, we were very much all in the throes of the low-fat movement. Unfortunately, that movement is still alive today. It should have died a death decades ago, but it's still around.
All right, but you're saying unfortunately. You've just said unfortunately the movement is still around.
Oh, yes. Unfortunately, the movement is still around. It's one of those walking dead things that it just will not die despite the evidence, despite the overwhelming amount of research that's been done. People are still, yesterday was my birthday. One of my dearest friends for 28 years took me out for breakfast and said, I hope you won't be mad at me, but I'm ordering the egg white omelet. I've only written about 50 times in 50 different articles that the egg white omelet was the stupidest nutritional experiment in history, but people still order it, even people who should know better. So, not to divert too quickly, I went in full-throated believer in low-fat. It was 1990. We were, you know, we had commercials on television like Susan Powder screaming, stop the insanity. And everybody, you know, believed that the way to lose weight was to cut your calories and get on that Stairmaster. And if you weren't losing weight, you needed to get on it longer and you needed to cut calories more. And, you know, and I was one of those people, Pamela, who would order egg whites, just like my friend did yesterday. And if it came with even a little bit of yellow, even a little bit of yolk, I'd send it back because I was so frightened of any amount of fat, any amount of cholesterol. I was quite sure this would be just the end of me. So I was a true believer. And then around 1991, 92, Dr. Atkins published the third version of his new diet revolution, which had originally come out in the 70s. And everybody knows the Atkins diet, very, very, very low in carbs, very high in fat, moderate in protein. Anyway, people misunderstand it a lot, but they think it's all about bacon. But it was definitely a diet that had had a lot of followers and over the years. And it was being re-released in the early 90s, and it was getting a lot of attention. And there was even a bit of research going on about it. But we trainers, and every doctor I ever met at the time, and every health professional I ever met at the time, thought that the Atkins diet was madness, that it was dangerous, that you would die of a heart attack if you ate all that fat and all that protein, and this was just the worst thing in the world, and they wanted to bring Atkins up on medical malpractice charges. I mean, it was just a whole thing. So in this, I hope I'm explaining this environment properly. So in this environment, we had some clients who would come in and say, you know what, this low-fat thing, it's just not, I'm gonna try Atkins. And I and everybody else would say, you can't do that. Sure, you might lose a pound or two, but my God, you're going to die. You can't do that. It's not worth losing a couple of pounds to get a heart attack. They'd do it anyway. And then they'd come back, and they hadn't died. Uh-huh. In fact, they'd lost weight. Their blood pressure had gone down. Their triglycerides had gone down. I didn't know this at the time, but I know it now. I know it in the subsequent years. So they had better blood tests. They had more energy. Their belly was shrinking. And we have a term in psychology for this. It's called cognitive dissonance. It means two ideas can't exist that are contradictory, can't exist in the same space. The mind has to do something to make them congruent, to make them come out alive. And here were the two ideas were, Atkins diet causes heart attacks, but here are patients coming back who are improved on the Atkins diet. These two facts don't fit in the same brain. So I was scratching my proverbial head going, something's wrong here. These people aren't dying. They look great. It seems to be working. Something is not correct. Could it be what we were taught about fat and cholesterol is not so? Is that even possible? And that became my personal journey in kind of discovering that most of what we have been taught about nutrition is complete, you know what, and that we have been misled and told the wrong things and followed the wrong diets and believed in the wrong principles. And I believe that that is probably why we are seeing an epidemic of people being fat, sick, tired, and depressed. So into this kind of milieu, Equinox was lucky enough to have a guest lecturer come to town who wanted to talk to the trainers. Now, he was unknown at the time. He was a kind of nerdy-looking biochemist from MIT. And his name was Barry Sears. And none of us had heard of him, but he had just released a book called The Zone, which, of course, went on to be an international bestseller.
Yes.
And spawned an entire, you know, industry of books, you know, the anti-aging zone, the omega zone, the this zone, the that. And Barry Sears, of course, is one of the leading lights in research in diet and omega-3s. And at the time, he had just put out this book, and it was a very revolutionary concept. He was saying, you know what, guys? You're eating too many carbs, not enough protein, not enough fat. And whereas the food pyramid and all these crazy, you know, low-fat things were telling us to eat 60, 70, 80% of carbohydrates, a little bit of protein, and as little fat as you could get in, Barry was saying, let's split it up into thirds. Like about 40% carbs, 30% fat, 30% protein. Today it sounds almost quaint when people are going on almost zero-carb diets,
right,
and ketogenic diets and doing, you know, a much more extreme version of that. But at the time, this was revolutionary because it was completely against what the American Dietetic Association was teaching and the American Medical Association. And he gave this stunning lecture in which the central concept was, and it's one that I believe to this day, and it's one that all my colleagues believe to this day, that weight gain is not driven by calories, it's driven by hormones, like most things in the human body. And he taught that food had a hormonal effect, well beyond its caloric pedigree, that you could not tell somebody's health by how many calories they ate, but you could tell a lot about their hormones and their hormonal health by what kinds of calories they ate. This was revolutionary. And I went up to Barry, I'll never forget, I went up to him afterwards, and I said, Dr. Sears, if what you say is right, then basically what you're saying is everybody else is wrong. And I don't know if you know Barry Sears, but he is a very confident man, a very charming man, and he simply looked at me and he said, well, that's quite correct. Everybody else is wrong. And that kind of began a lifelong mentorship. He wrote the introduction to my first book. I recently interviewed him on my Truth About Fat Loss Summit. He's given me quotes for books, and we've stayed in touch over the 20 years, and he's just a great guy. But that was the beginning of the turnaround for me, seeing the light and saying, wait a minute, something's missing here. It's not about low fat. It's not just about calories, and it's not just about exercise. And by the way, this has all been vindicated over the last 20 years. We now know that there are so many things that affect weight. Hormones, metabolic disruptors, hormone disruptors, endocrine disruptors in the environment, obesogens, the microbiome, which maybe we'll talk about a little bit later, which is an exploding area of nutritional research, all to do with the gut and what's in the gut and the bacteria and fungi and microbes that live in your gut that outnumber the cells you have as human cells in your body, and how those have a profound effect on weight gain and mood and depression and even schizophrenia. And so we're finding out that this equation of what puts weight on is so much more complicated than we were taught in the simplistic model of just cut the fat and do more exercise. And in the course of that, we victimized people. We made these people feel, anyone who was overweight, feel it was their fault. We made them feel that if they weren't losing weight on our stupid low-fat programs, it was their fault, instead of maybe thinking the advice we're giving them is wrong.
Johnny, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, I'm going to ask you about the psychological impact of the change from what people were taught to learning that everything was different and now what they're learning now. Folks,
sure.
We'll be right back. I know that you know that the way people think about themselves, the way they think about the way they look, how they look to others, is so complicated. And it is, for many people, really quite consuming. So if on the one hand we have a certain piece of information and so then folks sort of settle into, this is the way I need to be healthy. I'm not even saying this is what I need to be healthy and I'm going to do it. But just, this is what I need to be healthy. And now what we're hearing is, no, all that stuff was not so great, would create some sense of something within these folks who now are really even more confused and more concerned about what they were confused and concerned about to begin with, which is weight, weight loss, appearance, health, and all of that.
That's absolutely right, and we every health professional I know that deals with clients or that deals with this kind of thing, especially in the area of weight, meets people every day, whether it be professionally or personally, who say, "I'm so confused. Why can't you guys make up your mind? One day you say butter's bad. One day you say butter's good. One day you say fat is out. One day you say fat is in." Of course, they're confused, and I like to back. There's a couple of things I'd like to say to that. And the first is that, of course, you're confused, but part of the confusion comes from people not really understanding how science works. We just went through an election in which literally there were two different, I'm not, without talking politics or whose side we were on, any of that, I think everybody on both sides can agree that people saw two different universes. They assembled facts in two different ways. And even with the same facts, remember, facts are neutral. They're just a bunch of numbers. So you still need someone to put them together to make a theory. This is the projection for what's going to happen economically if these things go, if we can assume this level of employment and this level of whatever. There's a lot of statistical assumptions, and people can come to very different conclusions, as we just saw for a year in a very acrimonious political debate. What people need to understand is the same thing happens in science. Now, we don't hear about it when it's physicists arguing about particles, but we hear about it when it's about nutrition, because we all have to eat. And it isn't like the entire scientific community, whatever that is, gets together, has a conference, and comes out and says, "Here it is, this is the truth." You have these tiny studies, incremental knowledge. This one says, well, in this population, this happens. Then another study says, well, yeah, but when we tried to duplicate it, it didn't happen. And that's how knowledge progresses in science. So of course there are going to be different theories. Of course there are going to be different interpretations of the data. There's hundreds of examples of this. And, if you wanted to be unkind, you could call it cherry-picking the evidence, which means that there's endless numbers of facts that will support endless numbers of theories. And very often, people have a theory, vegetarian is better, and they can find enough facts to support that. And somebody who believes the opposite can find enough facts to support that. So, yes, there is confusion. Get over it. Accept it. It's life. It's how science progresses. Now, that said, what is the confused consumer supposed to do? They're not a scientist. They're not spending all their time at conferences and reading all these journal articles and listening to these arguments among, people who study this stuff for a living. So I always like to take the helicopter view and say, if you're confused, here's a couple of basic things to remember. Eat real food. Forget for the moment about what the proportion of protein, carbs, and fat are. Forget for the moment whether it's omega-3 or omega-6. Forget for the moment whether or not, it's sugar or turbinado sugar or high fructose. Just eat real food. I call it the real food intervention. And it's a very simplistic way to look at it. But if you had one thing to hold on to, one thing to take from this interview, one thing to take from any of the books I've written, any of the books anywhere, it's real food trumps everything. And when I say real food, let's be clear about that. It doesn't come in a box. It's not your quote-unquote healthy cereal. It's not it's not a pasta and breads and things that can keep on a shelf for a year. It's stuff your great-grandmother would have recognized as food. It's stuff that would spoil if you put it outside. It's stuff that was raised, if it was an animal, that was raised in its natural environment. So for meat, that means grass-fed only. For vegetables and stuff, it means growing in the soil and actually getting nutrients from that soil. So we're talking about real food, and if we made one single intervention in people's lives and they threw out everything that was processed or served in a restaurant and just stuck to actual food that they could buy in a farmer's market and ate that way for 30 days, you'd have a revolution in this country because of how good people would feel and how different they would feel, and they wouldn't have to know anything about diet or proportions of protein, fat, and carbs. And of course, we can talk about all that. There's a lot of theories, a lot of research, a lot of information and interesting data on all that. But if your head is spinning with all of the conflicts about nutrition and health and supplements and all the other things that I hope we'll get into as well, take one thing away from it. Is it real food or is it not? If it's not, if it's processed, if it has a long shelf life, just throw it out and try that for 30 days. And you will be amazed at the differences in every metric that you look at. Your energy, your libido, your digestion, your sleep, your skin, they will all improve.
I think what you've just done is horrified at least a portion of the population who thought that real food came in a box or a can, or you could pick it up from the line as you were driving through the fast food. You're making people crazy now.
Yeah, well, this is the thing, and it's you mentioned that, I'm known as the nutrition mythbuster. One of the things that excites and makes me passionate about that is, we are swimming upstream here. We are trying to swim to the surface with rocks attached to our feet because everywhere we look, the media is telling us the opposite of what I'm saying here.
Right.
So we can have this wonderful interview, you and me, Pamela, and we can talk about this stuff. We could even agree on 99% of what we say, and we could say this is what people should do, and then people go out into the world and see, 10,000 commercials a year for fast food, promises that are completely bogus, slept showing models with 2% body fat eating Carl Jr.'s dripping burgers with cheese and bread and stuff. And yeah, I can eat this and have 1% body fat on the beach. No, you can't. It's not true. And yet it is such an uphill battle. Every stupid, you know, every time there's an ingredient that gets a little bit of buzz, like omega-3s, some food processing company will come up with a candy bar and says, now with omega-3s in it, and the public thinks, oh, that's got to be healthy because omega-3s are good, right? So it's in that, you know, and they mislabel and they mislead, and you have this endless amount of media stuff, and not only the media, but the main health organizations, the American Heart Association, they approve stuff, you know, AHA approved candy bars, I mean, cereals, you can't even believe the stuff that gets the American Heart Association seal of approval. The American Diabetes Association is still teaching people to eat high-carb diets for diabetes. I mean, this would be the equivalent of telling someone with cancer to smoke. I can't even think of an analogy that's more dramatic than the idiocy of telling people with diabetes to eat high-carb diets. So we're up against so much information, both from the media, from commercial interests, and even from well-meaning health organizations, that it is really an uphill battle. And I always remember something, Malcolm. I was alive during the, I just turned a big birthday, which I'll tell you about in a second, and wrote an article about it on my blog, which I'd love everybody to read. But I was around when Malcolm X was around. And Malcolm X used to say, when I speak to an audience, and there's a couple thousand people out there, if one of them hears my message, then it's a successful talk. So I don't have any illusions that, you know, I go out and talk about this message about real food and about, you know, healthy supplements, and I hope we get a minute to talk about some of those, and about lifestyle things, which I've learned are just as important as the nutrition, your contribution to the people around you, your relationships. All of those things have such profound effects on health. All of the stuff we're learning in the last couple of decades, how the mind influences everything from digestion to hormonal release to neurotransmitters, just everything. So we can go out and preach this message and preach this message until we're blue in the face. Most people aren't going to hear it, but I always remember what Malcolm X said. If I can reach one or two people who go, holy moly, what that guy said made sense, I'm going to look into this. That's a success.
You know, from that perspective, it actually has a calming effect, I think, on folks who are listening, and almost gives them the space to be curious about what they may have rejected just a few minutes ago.
I hope that's true. One of the reasons I talk so openly about my history of drug addiction and alcoholism, and boy, I'm telling you, I was a hot mess during my musical career. One of the reasons I talk about that is if you saw me now, you would say, wait a minute, that's impossible. Because truly, Pamela, so help me God, if there was justice in the world, I should look like Keith Richards. I mean, you know, because that's how I lived. And I should look like somebody who's like, is he 90? Is he even still alive? I can't believe it. And I don't. And I mentioned yesterday that I had a big birthday yesterday, and I wrote an essay on it. And it's on my blog. I'd love people to look at it. It's called What It Feels Like to Be 70.
What's your blog address?
JohnnyBowden.com, JohnnyBowden.
Okay.
And it's also on my Facebook page, Dr. Johnny Bowden.
Okay.
But I wrote about what my journey was like and where I started and where I am today. And I absolutely believe, although I had a little help, which probably had some great genetics and good parents and, you know, a lot of help along the way. But I totally believe that I turned my life around by following basic principles of nutrition, by doing this with food and supplements and lifestyle. And if I could do it, me, the most undisciplined, you know, hot mess you can imagine, that's why I talk about where I came from, because I know that whoever's listening to this and thinks, that doesn't apply to me, yeah, it does apply to you.
Let me ask you this. I mean, you're right. I mean, we more and more recognize the power of our thoughts on every system in our body.
Yep.
And we more and more recognize the power of stress on every system in our body. Let's talk for a moment about stress. Talk to us about stress. You've said stress makes you fat.
Well, I've said stress makes you fat, gives you heart attacks, can contribute to cancer and diabetes. Look, here's the thing. I've written two books in which I address this. A few years, many, I don't know how many years ago, in 2008, 2009, I wrote a book called The Most Effective Ways to Live Longer. And I delved deeply into the copious research on aging. There's just, as I know you know, but maybe people listening don't, there's just hundreds of studies of aging populations, the Nun study. They go back in time. They say, what do these people do differently, the ones who got Alzheimer's versus the ones who didn't? And there's a lot of research. And I looked at all of it, or as much of it as I could possibly read, and I extrapolated from that that there were basically four things that age us. And they weren't organ-specific or brain-specific or heart-specific. They were body-specific. They did their damage all throughout the body, and they hit every organ. I always like to say they're like the Pashtun tribes in Pakistan. They don't care about national boundaries. They just go wherever they want. That's what they do. And that's kind of what these things do to our bodies. And the four things that I identified as major promoters of aging were oxidative stress, inflammation, sugar in the diet, and stress, one of the four biggest promoters of disease. And I'll get into that in a second. Then in 2012, we wrote our probably most successful book. I wrote it with a cardiologist named Steven Sinatra, and the book was called The Great Cholesterol Myth. And we identified four things that promoted heart disease. Guess what they were? The same four things. And
interesting.
stress. Yeah. So stress, if you look at almost any disease, you will see a place for stress. We call it a promoter. Now, what that means is it's not that it necessarily causes every disease. It doesn't. But it can bring on an attack. Think of herpes, for example, which is completely brought, can be brought on by stress in some. It can make a disease worse. It can make recovery longer. It can shorten your life. It can shrink a portion of your brain called the hippocampus that's involved in memory and thinking. And it can add belly fat. Those are all the things that stress does. And it goes back to the Barry Sears thing we talked about earlier, that everything we do has a hormonal effect. Stress is not just in your head. It starts with a perception, perhaps, but then it goes to the adrenal glands, which secrete actual hormones, cortisol, adrenaline. And those hormones have significant metabolic consequences. So stress actually is at the center of just about everything we're talking about. And how do you bring down stress? You got to do it with lifestyle. There's no pill you can take to bring down stress. There's a couple of things that are calming, sure, but basically you got to work on stress on your own. So it's a very, I'm glad you brought it up, Pamela. It's a very, very important part of health and disease.
Well, now that you've stressed everybody out about stress.
No. But there's no point in being. If that's like, to me, guilt, for example, is useless if it doesn't lead to action.
Absolutely.
And, you know, to be stressed about something, let's do something about it. It's not that hard. Let me give you my Johnny Bowden 4 minute, you know, it's not a solution, but it's a start.
I'll take it.
Take a couple minutes every day, and hopefully you can get this up to a few more times a day than once, but let's start with once. Sit at your darn desk and just do deep breathing. Just sit there, close your eyes, put your palms on your knees, open your legs, open your heart, take a deep breath, five, kind of long count of five in, hold it for five, release it for five. And do that, set your timer on your iPhone for 4 minutes. It literally will lower your blood pressure, it will change your brain waves, and it will definitely calm the stress. It's like putting the pressure, you know, taking a pressure cooker and having that little hole that lets the steam come off. So there's nothing, you don't have to be stressed out about having stress. Do something about it. And we all need to acknowledge, the first step is acknowledging that it's not, you know, all of this 1980 stuff, oh, I'll sleep when I'm dead. You know, I only need 3 hours of night of sleep. I'm a big doer and a getter. Yeah, you're going to pay the metabolic price for that. That's a guarantee. So if we first have to acknowledge that we're not supermen and superwomen, and that this is a real phenomenon, and it's not all in your head, and it has real metabolic consequences, so deal with it. So find a way to actually give yourself some time. Caretakers are remarkably bad at this because they never find time for themselves. They only take care of others, and they all it really takes is just putting a little time aside for yourself. Take a bubble bath. Take a walk. Do some deep breathing, like I just suggested. The best, of course, is meditation, but quite honestly, I can't do it. It's very difficult for many people. People who stick with it, the results are stunning. There's tons of research going back to the 70s on the Mind-Body Institute in Harvard that lowers blood pressure, extends life, does all kinds of things. But if you don't want to make the commitment to meditation, do the four-minute deep breathing. Take a bubble bath. Go for a walk in the green. There's a lot of ways that you can burn off stress, including exercise, by the way.
Johnny, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we will continue. And I'd like for you to be able to talk a little bit about sleep and the importance of sleep.
Okay.
Folks, don't go away. We're coming right back with Dr. Johnny Bowden. Johnny, I did your name a disservice a moment ago.
Don't worry about it, Bowden. Yeah, that's
Dr.
okay.
Dr. Johnny Bowden. For those who might just be joining us, Dr. Bowden is known as the nutrition mythbuster. He has written over 15 books all about health and nutrition. Johnny, talk to us about sleep. So many people say, I'm too busy to sleep.
Yeah, right. Well, I'd love to talk about sleep, and I know we're on the last segment. God, you're a great interviewer. This went so fast. I do want to at least touch on, we've talked about food, and I would love to at least touch on supplements, because that's another area very deeply misunderstood. We keep reading every week, it seems I read some stupid, misinformed, biased article, even in the New York Times, saying, oh, supplements don't work yet. They do. So let's make sure that we talk a little bit about that, because that's one of the myths I really would love to bust.
Absolutely.
And let's start with the one you just asked about, which is sleep. So, look, everybody, I understand profoundly that it is not always easy in a stressed 21st century life in these times to get deep, relaxing sleep. But let me just explain to you why it's important and how important it is. We could probably talk, if I had my research papers in front of me and I had the studies, I could probably talk for over an hour on the studies that have been done on even preventing people from having one extra hour of sleep. Like if they normally sleep 7 hours and you make them sleep six, or you do a laboratory experiment where you take college kids and you give them only 4 hours sleep, and then they do all these metabolic tests, blood tests, blood pressure, triglycerides, everything you can imagine, everything gets worse. Everything. The body sees undersleeping as a stressor. So if I've convinced you that when our bodies are over-releasing stress hormones, metabolic chaos takes place. If I've convinced you of that, then understand that not sleeping enough is just turns on the fire of those stress hormones. Because the body is basically, our bodies have a very primitive, our brains have a very primitive part. We often call it affectionately the lizard brain. It's just the most fundamental stuff. And your brain does not know the difference in terms of stress between, say, being stuck on the 405 highway out here in California in the traffic jam and being chased by a lion. It doesn't understand the difference between, you know, a real danger and not sleeping enough. Not sleeping enough in our primitive times is associated with danger. You had to be on the move. The other tribes were going to get you, the lions, and were going to attack you. So clearly, you know, on a very primitive level, when we're not sleeping enough, everything isn't working. Scientists don't really completely 100% understand all the things that happen during sleep. Biochemicals are reproduced and replenished, and all kinds of nourishing things take place in ways that aren't 100% understood. But what we do understand is that it's absolutely needed for the vital running of a metabolism. And when you don't sleep enough, or when you sleep badly, or when you sleep and wake up 15 times a night, or it really plays metabolic havoc. And I can just tell you that this is incontrovertible, the research on this. So what do we do? Well, there's a couple of things that, you know, I've written about this myself. A lot of people have written about this. What are some tricks you can do? Well, the first thing you can do is get your darn email and computer out of your bedroom. The second thing you can do, you're not Hugh Hefner, you're not going to work in bed, make the bedroom separate, make it for sleep and play. That's it. It is not an office. The second thing is get it dark. There's studies on this as well. We actually, even if it's the VCR light in the old days, or, you know, just the humming of it, does disrupt sleep on some profoundly deep level. Remember, there are stages of sleep. You want to go through all five of them. It's very important that you cycle through that. If you wake people during that time, they don't get the restful sleep that they need. So you really need a dark room. You need a temperature probably around, most experts I've talked to think about 68 or so. 69 is a great temperature to sleep in. Make sure the bed is comfortable. Try to give yourself a half-hour news break before you go to bed. You don't want, you know, images of beheadings in your head before you go to sleep. Do not fall asleep with the television on, or you'll have dreams all night of whatever's going on in the infomercial will stick into your brain. I remember waking up at 3 in the morning thinking about Thigh Masters, because that's what they were talking about, or, you know, PX90 or any of the things that they go on and on about at 3 in the morning will seep into your sleep and into your brain and into your dreams. So make a quiet, restful place, cool, comfortable, and make it your sanctuary, and give yourself that time every night. And the best way to add sleep, if you're only sleeping 4 hours, it's not to stay in bed longer, it's to go to bed earlier. That has been shown time and time again to be a more effective way to actually add to the number of hours that you sleep.
Now, for those folks who say, well, I didn't get any sleep this week, but I'm going to make up for it on the weekend. I'm going to sleep until 2 o'clock. On Saturday.
Well, it's definitely better than nothing. I mean, you can make up some of it, but you can't. It's a very temporary strategy that it's definitely better than nothing to try to catch up some of it. But it's not something you can't borrow from it on a daily basis and then pay it back on the weekend.
Gotcha.
Maybe once in a while, if you've been a little undersleeping during the week, you can definitely take an extra few hours in bed on the weekend, and that will help a little bit. But that is not a sustainable strategy in general. You really need that rest every single day. It also, when you're stressed like that, I'm sure people have had this experience, you will eat anything that's in sight the next day. These are very primitive, hormonally driven appetite things that actually worked for us in our primitive days when we were, you know, cavemen, because that kind of stress means there's going to be an emergency and I better fuel up. So your brain is literally driving you, and you have no control, and there's no prefrontal cortex activity that's saying, hey, dude, don't eat that Dunkin' Donuts thing, you know, because all you're doing is feed me, feed me, feed me. I'm so tired. I'm sleepwalking through the day. And I think many people have had that experience of just, you know, all the controls go out the window. So really, believe me about this. Sleep is a very, very important component of health.
I believe you.
Johnny,
let's do this.
A little bit about supplements.
I was about to say, let's move on to supplements.
Fantastic. So I'm a big believer in supplements. I take more than most people take, and I'm not telling everybody to go out and take 40 or 50 things a day. I've been doing that for many, many years. I do think it's a big part of why I'm healthy, not the only thing, but it has a lot to do with it. And I always, when people say, well, what should I take? I don't know anything. I have like a top 10 list. And you can go in all kinds of different directions with this. You know, for liver health, for example, I was a big drinker, so I take special things for the liver to just keep it healthy and kind of, you know, rehabilitate it a little bit from all those years of abuse. You can take special things for skin. I'm a big believer in collagen supplements. I love them. I do believe that that's a big reason that my skin looks as good as it does. The brand I use actually is Sauvage, and think it's just wonderful, and so I take that for the skin. But if we're talking about top 10 things, if we're talking about things that I think that just almost everybody would benefit from, here's my list. We start with a multiple only because it's going to fill in gaps of the things we're not taking separately, like selenium and folic acid and things like that, and the B vitamins. So we start with something like a multiple. The next one is omega-3s, fish oil. Probably the most valuable thing I can think of next to a multiple for almost everybody. No one gets enough. They're anti-inflammatory. They lower triglycerides. They're good for the brain. They're good for the heart. They're just great. Fish oil. Vitamin D. There's an epidemic of low vitamin D, and vitamin D has been associated with about 100 different diseases. Don't believe what the authorities say. Oh, you only need 600 IUs for bone health. It's related to cancer. It's related to performance. It's related to physical effort. It's related to depression. It's related to just the multiple sclerosis. There's a million different things that vitamin D, low levels of vitamin D, are related to. So we all need a vitamin D supplement, unless you're living in the middle of the tropics and you have white skin. That's about the only time that you don't need vitamin D. Magnesium. Hugely important, lowers blood pressure, relaxes the arteries. It's needed for 300 different metabolic operations. Probiotics, because as I mentioned earlier, the health of the gut is turning out to be one of the biggest metrics for the health of the body. It's related to just about everything. So we need to populate that gut with good bacteria, and that's what probiotics and prebiotics, all of that stuff, really important. And then two of the ones, and vitamin K, because we don't get enough of that. And then two of the ones that I don't want to call them designer nutrients, but they've really taken off in the last 10 years or so. People have really begun to understand and appreciate how important these two are. And the first is resveratrol. Resveratrol is the substance found in red wine and in the skins of dark grapes. And it's been researched forever as an anti-aging substance because there's a lot of amazing studies showing that it turns on genes called the CERT genes that are associated with aging and longevity. So resveratrol, absolutely, and again, the same brand, by the way, Resveratrol, because they use exclusively the active ingredient resveratrol. This is one of the things that drives me nuts about supplement manufacturers. You can go into a big box store and see a bottle of 500 milligrams of resveratrol, but unless you know to look for trans-resveratrol, which is the active component, you look on the back and it's got only 3% trans. No, well, Resveratrol has 100% trans. And that's, people don't need to know the technical part of that. It's just that's the active ingredient, folks. Okay. That's what you want. So I love resveratrol, and I love curcumin, which is the active ingredient in turmeric, the spice that makes Indian food yellow. And curcumin is also a magnificent modulator of so many different metabolic processes. It's anti-inflammatory. It has some anti-cancer activity. My favorite brand for that is Terry Naturally. It's found everywhere in Vitamin Shoppe and GNC. And Terry Naturally makes a really absorbable, high-quality form of curcumin. So, again, my top 10, I hope I didn't leave any out, a multiple, fish oil, magnesium, vitamin D, probiotics, vitamin K, resveratrol by Resveratrol, and curcumin by Terry Naturally. Those are my top choices.
Now, you mentioned box stores. Nowadays, you can walk, well, not only a box store, but you can certainly walk into box stores, and there are all kinds of chewable versions of what you're talking about. Are they?
Yeah, they vary, like every vitamin form, whether it's a powder, a chewable, a capsule, a tablet, they vary widely in quality. And, you know, unfortunately, most people don't. They go to magnesium. Okay, it's got magnesium in it. This is a cheaper one. I should get this. Well, as you know, and as most people don't know, all of these things, all of these minerals, and they come in different forms. And if you looked at if you spent a few minutes looking at the back of the envelope, so to speak, at the ingredients, you'd see there's magnesium oxide, there's magnesium glycinate, there's magnesium citrate, there's magnesium carbonate. There's all these different forms of it, and some are much more absorbable than others. Some are much more potent than others. And, you know, as I was just saying with resveratrol, you know, it's trans resveratrol that you want, and you've got to look for that. So don't be fooled by the bargains in vitamins. You know, when I first started in the 90s back in New York, there was an integrative doctor in New York who had a sign up in his office, and I loved this. He said, there are three things you should never look for bargains. One, parachutes. Two, tattoos. And three, vitamin supplements. And he was right. You know, look, this is the thing. The cheapest, crappiest vitamin supplement, the difference in price between that and the highest quality is not that big. It's not like the difference between a cheap car and, you know, a $1 million Ferrari. It's the difference between a buck and $2. You know, it's not a lot of difference. And why not get the stuff your body's actually going to use and make use of, and that's going to really nourish and fuel you?
It sounds like it's the difference between not health and health.
Well, I mean, why spend money on vitamin capsules and tablets that aren't going to, you know, aren't going to be absorbed or aren't going to do very well or aren't going to break down or in a form that you buy? Look, vitamin E is another great example. We've been, you know, touting vitamin E supplements, which are really D-alpha tocopherol supplements. And by the way, that's one of eight forms of vitamin D, and it's probably the least effective one. So we've got to be a little more careful about what's in these supplements. Supplements, you know, they can be very misleading, you know, when they say it's vitamin E. Well, it's only one fraction of vitamin E. It's not the other seven. What about those? And some of those are more important than the one that they put in. Vitamin D is another example of this. For years, they were using a form that's just not absorbed well. And then all the medical people who hate supplements to begin with, they say, hey, it doesn't work. Yeah, you used the wrong form of it, dude. So we have to be careful to go with companies that we really trust to not pull the wool over our eyes and to give us forms of these vitamins and nutrients and nutraceuticals that are actually usable and effective by the human body.
I noticed that I didn't hear you mention vitamin C or B complex.
That's because I'm hoping that those will be in the multiple.
Okay.
See, we could go on. We could take every one of these things. Vitamin C, wonderful. Vitamin E, wonderful. Folic acid, absolutely essential. Selenium. But then you wind up with 20 different things, and you probably missed a couple, like maybe you missed vitamin B6. So if you get a high-quality multiple, at least you're going to get some of that. And I'm also assuming people are going to eat food. You know? So they're going to eat some fruits and vegetables, which are going to have vitamin C. But yes, there's no question that those are important. I'm just trying to come up with a list that actually people could maybe manage.
Gotcha. Johnny, you have given us so much information, and the time is completely flying by. Tell us where folks can go for more information about you and what you're doing.
Sure. JohnnyBowden.com, which is J-O-N-N-Y. There's no H in Johnny. J-O-N-N-Y-B-O-W-D-E-N. JohnnyBowden.com. And on Facebook, Dr. Johnny Bowden. And all my articles and all my links and stuff like that. And I also have I did a summit last year in which I interviewed 38 thought leaders in the field of metabolism and weight loss and all the things that you and I, Pamela, have been talking about today. And I interviewed about 38 different people, all on video. And I put together a package of 10 of my favorite interviews, and it's free. And if you go to my website where it says Become a Dr. Johnny VIP, the VIP package is 10 interviews which will be sent to you or downloaded absolutely free. And you can listen to those interviews, including one with me. I hope people will avail themselves of that because it's really great information.
That's terrific. Johnny, thank you again so much for joining us today.
Oh, you're so welcome. Thank you so much for having me, Pamela.
My pleasure.
Bye-bye.
And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service. It is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a licensed medical or mental health professional or other professional. Mind Talk is available on demand by going to myndtalk.org, or you can download the Mind Talk app from the iTunes store. If you would like to be in touch with me directly, that email address is Pamela, P-A-M-E-L-A, at mindtalk.org. That's MYNDTALK.org. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26 by 2 Communications. And folks, I remind you that if it is unacceptable, then that is precisely what it is. Unacceptable. You take care.